There was a time at which, especially in the late 70s and 80s, where people would identify, I am Tourette syndrome, but that sometimes would make them into the disease. Their whole life was around the disease. And as you pointed out with the examples of people who can do something else and their tics go away, at least for that time period, means there's a lot more they can do. So I think that's going to make a bigger difference.
Welcome to The Uptick, brought to you by the New Jersey Center for Tourette Syndrome and Associated Disorders, empowering children and adults through education, advocacy, and research by sharing the stories and experiences relevant to the TS community.
Hello, and welcome to part two of our special deep dive on the history of Tourette syndrome. Let's jump right in.
One thing I was curious about was in the early days, in the 1800s, the emphasis on coprolalia and that being the big thing that it was believed to evolve into, that and echolalia. Is it fair to say that that early characterization of this condition is ultimately what kind of paved the way for the future of Tourette being labeled, associated with this swearing condition, this kind of blurting out obscenities? Is it fair to say that started in the 1800s?
But it got strongest in the 1940s under Margaret Mahler. Mahler, we say, well, do you have to have this clinical sign? So if they didn't have echolalia or coprolalia, she would argue that they're repressing it because of masturbation.
Wow. Okay.
And if the child in the examining room and she followed them didn't display coprolalia or echolalia, she'd still say that's a sign of even deeper disorder. It's almost laughable if it weren't so sad. She was convinced that all these things were repressed sexuality. Of course, her whole attitude towards sexuality has changed so much that so it was a disorder to be a masturbator.
Wow.
They did masturbation. That showed that they were really masturbating.
Well, I mean, I imagine this underpinned a lot of how they explained a lot of conditions, not just this, like a lot of it came down to this theme.
Especially psychoanalytic pediatrics, blaming the parents and early childhood conflict, were all ascribed to a disorder rather than to a weakened ego. But at the same time, they would also admit there was an organic substrate.
Like it's organic, but also it's your fault or it's your bad habits.
Right. So if you can't find this behavior, then that's evidence that underlying behavior for the tics and vocalizations, then that's even more evidence that it's there. No matter how they cut it, they would always blame the situation and the patients. One of the kids at the end of the chapter, I talk on Mallory, says, I don't know what you're saying. This is a sex thing. I don't think about sex. I just want to get rid of my tics. And he said, you're doing witchcraft.
One of the things that stood out to me was how even in the early days, like Miege and Fendel observed that their patients with tics, the tics would often subside when they were engrossed in something they found interesting. The tics would dissipate. Can you talk about that? Because that is so true. And we talk about that a lot today. It's part of how we coach people. It's find your passions, find hobbies, find things that that really engross you, because that is a coping mechanism. It's one of the closest things to a cure that we have. It was enlightening to me to learn that was such an early discovery or an early observation, was that this did happen when they were really engrossed in something.
Yeah, I think, you know, this ability to have a different focus and work as an actor, for instance, even learning roles from plays and things, which would be difficult just sitting around, but it's very interesting why that takes place. And yet that sometimes when you have people who are able to defer a tic for a while, that sometimes later it comes back when they're no longer doing that. And I think that's a really good area of research for someone to look at, why they wax and wane to begin with. But the best clinical approach would be what waxes and wanes. And again, it's infectious diseases and the anti-infectious diseases. So that's there. They weren't in the 1920s, depending where you look, you don't really have much sympathy or much discussion of its waning because they don't follow patient long enough. Mm. And what patient, who has an array of everything. They had the theory of explaining it before they even had the case itself. This case was used to justify their theory. What's interesting, I think, is whatever the dominant medical, particularly psychiatric theory of the time is, it always becomes the causes for Tourette syndrome. So the causes keep changing with the changing of, say, of psychiatry. And now we live in a world where we look at most infectious disorders, and where we look more at other kinds of organic disorders. So the I don't think we've reached the end of our explanations of Tourette's syndrome by any means, I guess is what I mean.
So I would agree. Yeah.
It's a very interesting thing to study. I wish more people would do it.
I do too. You and me both. Tourette really came to the public forefront in the late 20th century, beginning with the emergence of the Tourette Syndrome Association. You talk about this in your book. In 1972, there was a group of New York City area parents. They had children with this condition. They started a support group. That was the origin of the organization, now the largest in the world for Tourette support and research and advocacy. And it sounds like in the early days of the TSA, they were really intent on replacing these dominant psychoanalytic frameworks that tied the condition to bad parenting, lack of discipline, early childhood sexual conflict. Is that a fair characterization?
Yeah, I think it's exactly right. I think the only thing I'd add, which doesn't detract from what you said, is that the parents would feel bad after a while when they had their kids on some meds, particularly Haldol. Because their children, there was a lot of rapid weight gain. The kids were unhappy. Mm-hmm. There's that. There's still the parental guilt. But certainly there was a real concerted effort by these people from New York City and Shapiro's to get their story out. And they were very open to me. I mean, they invited me to stay with them because they really wanted to come up with some explanation. But there were some very sad things that happened then, too, that I didn't write about. Which is the problem of siblings of people with Tourette syndrome or any other kind of pediatric psychiatric disorder. It's very difficult on the siblings as well. And sometimes the parents focus more on one than the other. I don't have any solution for that except to find the cure for the disorder. So they deserve a lot of credit. If you ask me what the most important thing in treatment would be, I would say support groups for kids with kids doing the support. Mm. Kids with Tourette's talking to one another, that really is helpful. I know introducing myself to many of the patients, they would all tell me that the most useful thing that they had was the chance to talk to other people and experience it. So when they were younger and it might have gotten worse over time, the signs and symptoms, they were more prepared. And also peer help is really important.
Oh, it's huge. I mean, now that the Tourette Association has a youth ambassador program rising, like they have a number of, I think there's a junior youth ambassador program as well. The organization this podcast is with, NJCTS, has a youth advocate program kind of similar. And that's the point of the, we take young people with this condition, teach them to be advocates, but you're also getting them in front of other young people with it. And I went through these programs growing up and I found getting to meet other people with it was so liberating and did so much for my own confidence. Because with the numbers on it, I mean, yeah, we are learning it's more common than we once thought. But still, a lot of kids are growing up not meeting someone else with it. It can be very isolating.
No, I think that's exactly right. If you ask yourself another question, how come there's so few Tourette's diagnoses earlier in, say, the first half of the 20th century? And so many more in the second half of the 20th century. Is there actually something that, what creates more? Is it ascertainment bias? In other words, we now have a label for this as a spectrum disorder from mild to very, very severe. Is that just it? Or is there something else? Is there an actual real increase? When I worked on another disorder, Kawasaki disease, that was the question I had to answer. Was there actually more Kawasaki disease? Or was there more ascertainment of it? And I think that's a good thing to always ask yourself when you're looking at these sorts of things.
Well, ADHD too. I mean, that one with the diagnosis of ADHD really exploding in recent decades. I've heard it there as well come up, that question.
Yeah, well, what happens when you add obsessive compulsive disorders, other kinds of focus disorders with other Tourette's, you get a much larger number. Maybe people also are less interested in trying to hide the fact that their kids have Tourette's and much more open about it, which makes it easier for everyone. I mean, I had a patient who would say whenever he got an airplane, there's a bomb on the plane, which not a good thing to say. But I think we've become much more accustomed to it. And we see a bigger spectrum of what constitutes Tourette syndrome and involuntary speech and other things.
Can you talk a little bit about the contributions of the Shapiros in reframing this condition as organic?
Yeah, I think they're quite heroes, actually. He kept running into the fact that these patients, he also read the literature and noticed that in Europe, there were a lot of people that were tying Tourette syndrome or the signs and symptoms of Tourette's to a wider population because they included obsessive compulsive behaviors and ADHD. And so if you add those in, and then all of a sudden you have more, and also you have more people willing to talk about it, since it's more, much more well-known. The Shapiros, they were at Cornell Hospital. They kept insisting this was organic, and essentially he couldn't get his article published following these patients. So finally, the only place he could get that famous now paper about Tourette syndrome can be treated with Haldol, he couldn't get it published in the United States, so it had to be published in the British Journal of Psychiatry. Wow. So that's the other thing. The politics of medicine and subcategories has a lot to do with what goes on. People are very much attached to their theories.
Yeah, yeah, that is human nature.
I had met Shapiro just as he was dying. I just got to town and was supposed to interview him. And when I was at their house, he got the phone call that he had prostate cancer.
Oh.
But they were very nice to me. They wanted to get their story out and did. He really gave the foundation, the Tourette's Foundation organizations, really their first legitimacy. Later on, they didn't all get along so well. Mrs. Dr. Shapiro was very generous with her time and efforts.
And it sounds like one of the best pieces of evidence that we had for Tourette being this organic biological etiology came from research by the Shapiros and others showing that medications like Haldol could help people. I mean, albeit with some nasty side effects and not fit for everybody.
Yeah, some people could tolerate it for much longer. Now, of course, the dose is much lower, and so the toleration is better. But it's very difficult for older people with Tourette's, as you know. And some have done remarkably well, and others have had more problems. And the cultural context in which they experienced, I think, makes a big difference.
I'm going to ask a question that is kind of impossible to answer. Some of it we've touched on already. If you were to predict the next 50 years of Tourette, frameworks, research, how we characterize it, how we describe it, in 50 years, how do you think this situation will look?
Well, I can only predict the past because I'm...
Right. So I said it's an impossible question.
Yeah, but I would say what's going to be taken much more seriously are post-infectious disorders and multifaceted disorders. The drugs we have now, there's an intervention, a therapeutic intervention, where you can go into the basal ganglia and change the on-off switches in the basal ganglia. Deep brain...
Oh, DBS. Yeah, yeah.
And it works. I've seen incredible examples of where it works for kids who couldn't walk off the pavement without jumping down five times or banging their head, that this operation worked. It also works for Parkinsonian patients at the opposite direction. It's the same structure, but one you want to increase dopamine, the other you want to decrease it. So anything that will be able to make the ganglia again, the brain will operate without having to do serious interventions, it's going to make a big difference. And so I think there'll be more neurobiology and more immunology. And the getting the collaboration between these different fields, which much more happens now, then I think that's going to open it much more and open lots of possibilities. So I think it'll be better. Also, our diagnostic tools are better, but sometimes not making a diagnosis can be as valuable as making a diagnosis.
Can you elaborate on that? That's an interesting point.
There was a time in which, especially in the late 70s and 80s, where people would identify, I am Tourette syndrome. But that sometimes would make them into the disease. Their whole life was around the disease. And as you pointed out with the examples of people who can do something else and their tics go away, at least for that time period, means there's a lot more they can do. So I think that's going to make a bigger difference. So much of our life is medicalized to begin with. I think there are ways that current interventions in neurobiology over time. DBS is also now used for obsessive compulsive disorders.
I read about that. Yeah. There's been some cases there.
A colleague of mine actually at that time at Emory. And there's a guy named Michael Okun. I don't know if you run into him in Florida. He was really good. He does what's called gamma knife interventions. He was also at Emory at the time.
And I've also seen new research coming out with like TMS, transcranial magnetic stimulation for tics. I am not familiar with efficacy of that. I know that's being studied. Also, cannabinoid region of our brain. There's also a number of anecdotal reports of patients finding benefit with marijuana, THC.
We know it works because they were using it.
I was going to bring that up. Yeah, you mentioned that.
And our 16 patients that we're following, adult patients, they had heavy marijuana use. It seemed to work pretty well, whereas alcohol and cigarette smoking does not work as well. But on the other hand, initially, sometimes cigarette smoking, although there's all kinds of downsides to it, I'm not advocating it. Sometimes it can get somebody through a period that's difficult. And maybe we could figure out ways to use nicotine in a more efficient way than we are.
Like coping.
So I wish I could answer your question about the future, but one thing for sure is I won't be here 50 years from now, but write to me.
Well, your contributions will still be felt. I mean, you put together an incredible book that just outlines the whole history from the 1800s to late 1900s. I do recommend it to our listeners who are looking to understand who were these initial doctors and the person our condition is named after. What was his contribution? It's a really well-written book.
Thank you very much. Thank you also for asking me to talk about it because it forced me to go back and look at it. And one of the things I found reading the book, I've been interested lately in stuttering. And a lot of Tourette's patients and people diagnosed were in fact stutterers from time to time. We looked at that very much in terms of handedness as well. There's a lot more to do that other people can do, move from where I was to what we've learned in the last 25 years.
Did you say that left-handedness is found more commonly in tic and Tourette communities, or did I just make that up?
No, you heard it, but I didn't explain it. When I was working in the hospital at Brown, I noticed that our patients, obsessive compulsive disorders, attention deficit, and Tourette's, seemed to be left-handed at a higher than predicted rate. So I was convinced at that point that there must be some relationship between handedness and movement disorders. So I kept that on the back shelf as something I would do. It turns out that it's much more complicated than that. And it was just an idea, but it's certainly not unimportant to figure out. We don't really agree on our definition of stuttering either. And that's changed. The King's Speech is a very good, if you ever get
that. Good movie. Yeah, I did see that.
When you work in a clinic with patients all the time, you see things you never see otherwise. But at least when I realized that this was probably an ascertainment bias. But who knows? There is something to it, but that's the time for another interview.
One last question. As someone who's seen many patients with this condition, what advice do you have for people with it? I always like to end my interviews with a question like this. What would you tell a Tourette patient, especially adults with it?
Well, I don't know. I'd have to have each case is different. Or so it's hard to say. But the one thing I would recommend was interaction with other people with Tourette's sometimes, especially for young kids. Each case really has a different, some people do really well on medications. Some of the TPS operations we did are amazing. Mm-hmm. I didn't do any. I was just part of the group. So I think that the movement's going to be more sophisticated understanding of the interaction of genetics and genes and infectious disease. Much more collaboration work will be done, and that's true every place. So it should be an exciting time to work on this and maybe to find some other interventions, but not hiding it and not feeling guilty would be where I'd start. And I certainly would encourage youth support groups, which I see there's many of now.
That is something we've done great work with, the TAA and JCTS, other Tourette organizations. There's summer camps now you can go to. I volunteer every August for the Tim Howard Leadership Academy, where we take high school students with tics and we teach them how to make that transition into adulthood. Driving, getting your first job with tics. Do I disclose in a job interview? What should first responders know about tics if I'm in an accident? We train them on these things. And I've seen that be so empowering for these students. And it's such a critical age, too, where you're 14 to 17 years old and starting to grapple with the emergence of adulthood. That is a time with lots of questions and challenges, and people need that support and support from others who get it, other young people with tics, adults who've had it for many years, you know, getting it from people who have lived it.
I think that's true. You don't want to romanticize disease. Some people do, and you don't want to ignore it. You know, if you asked me in 1992 when you were born what the future would be, I think it's been remarkable what's taken over and people of understanding, opening, and willingness to find this more widely. So I think having these institutions like the summer camp and other sorts of things, having annual meetings, these are all very helpful. Local chapters were a good thing at first, but they also sometimes would have a downside.
Well, now with the internet, I mean, people are finding support groups online and we can do so much more remotely too, connecting people.
Yes, we were able to do it today.
Exactly, like this.
I teach a seminar every week people from all over the United States, 15 of us. And we can meet because of the COVID, we start using Zoom and now we meet all the time.
Well, Dr. Howard, it's been wonderful chatting with you. This has been really enlightening.
Thanks, Michael.
Thank you for listening to The Uptick, brought to you by the New Jersey Center for Tourette Syndrome and Associated Disorders, empowering you to stretch the boundaries to live your best life. The NJ Center for Tourette Syndrome and Associated Disorders, NJCTS, its directors and employees assume no responsibility for the accuracy, completeness, objectivity, or usefulness of the information presented on this podcast. We do not endorse any recommendation or opinion made by any guest, nor do we advocate any treatment.